BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
My name is Ross Sutherland. This is the story of the artist Arthur Craven, who was born in Lausanne, Switzerland, in 1887, and who disappeared in Mexico in November 1918.
We wandered ceaselessly, arm in arm. All comparisons vanished, which is the trick of falling in love.
The last person to see Arthur Craven alive was his newly wedded wife, the poet and artist Mina Loy, who at the time was pregnant with their child.
A gush of sentiment inundated my heart.
The pair were on the run from the war. Craven was a deserter. They were supposed to sail to Chile together to start a new life. Craven had prepared the boat for the journey.
I perceived him as beautiful, like a farmer.
I forgot to tell you how I love you.
He took the boat out for a test sail one day and was never seen again. Mina eventually boarded a Japanese hospital ship alone, believing that her husband was still alive somewhere.
I believe that I could marry him.
After all, Arthur was a fighter. He was fearless. He'd used his skills as an artist to evade border patrols time and time again. Arthur Craven spent his entire life escaping any form of classification. Why would death be any different? He'd confound death just as he confounded everything else. By the time Mina's boat reached Chile, the war was over. Mina eventually made her way back to her parents in England, where she gave birth to a daughter, Jemima Fabienne Craven Lloyd. A name that brought together both of her father's identities, the name he took as an artist, Arthur Craven, combined with his birth name, Fabian Lloyd.
Fabienne became a close friend of mine. She literally embodied her father.
This is the first of the echoes of Arthur Craven, the sweetest and best.
A similarly statuesque presence. She was very forceful in her personality and physicality and intellect and very creative.
The other echoes that followed were more troubling.
Never met her father because she was born after her father had disappeared, but heard a lot about him from her mother, Mina Loy, and was fascinated by this heritage that she lived with all of her life, and that also remained a puzzle to her. And then she actually eventually ended up committing suicide, and that's a fact. It's not a fact of Arthur Craven's that we know, but it's a fact of his daughter, so in some way there's some kind of legacy there.
Roger Conover, the leading writer on Arthur Craven. When right after the disappearance, those stories first started, like those echoes. You know, I don't know where it was where someone suddenly goes like, oh no, hit Craven. Someone saw him in this city over there.
Beatrice Wood was the last surviving person who knew Arthur Craven and Mina Loy both. In fact, she was present when they met. And here's a letter she wrote me in 1986. Dear Roger, you sent me such a wonderful letter that I hesitate to take up pen in hand myself. I'm interested that you picked up a breadcrumb about Arthur Craven. Many in the art world will be thrilled for any further news. Why there is so much excitement around his disappearance, I do not know. But even in those far-off days in New York, there was an air of suspense and mystery whenever his name was spoken.
Mina wasn't the only person who thought Arthur Craven could still be alive. Craven's friends and associates believed it too.
This wasn't understood as a permanent vanishing at the time. This was just Arthur Craven's latest antic.
Soon, idle gossip began to spread.
Some others prefer to believe that marriage appalled him and that he has disappeared.
The writer Carl van Vechten, according to Craven's old drinking pal Blaise Cendres, Paris was awash with stories.
The rumour spread through Montparnasse without anyone's knowing where it had come from. that Arthur Craven had been murdered in a dance hall by a dagger thrust to the heart. The stuff of cinema.
Craven had always been the stuff of cinema. He'd spent his life pretending to be a precocious villain, his persona exaggerated, blown up, luminescent. Now that the body of Arthur Craven had disappeared, his myth grew to fill the gap, his scandalous persona becoming even wilder than it had been in his lifetime.
Here's a poster. Wanted, Arthur Craven, 1887 ? Still at large. Considered extremely intelligent and dangerous.
As theories passed from artist to artist at the bar, Craven became an unstoppable master of disguise, a phantom capable of anything.
Suspected and known aliases, Edward Archinard, Isaac Craven, Dorian Hope.
There were stories that Craven had told friends he was secretly planning to start a new life in Tahiti.
Known occupations, poet, professor.
Another theory connected Craven to B. Traven, the author of The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Very little is known of Traven, except that he was based in Mexico in the period immediately after Craven's vanishing. Could this have been yet another of Craven's aliases? Another theory believed that Craven returned to Paris and began to sell forged Oscar Wilde papers under the name Dorian Hope. Whoever this forger was, the con seemed uncannily designed to embroil Craven's enemies in Paris and England. Was this a revenge scheme from beyond the grave, or just proof that Craven inspired as many con men as he did artists? You could say that Craven spent his whole life paving the way for these kind of posthumous conspiracies. Even when Craven was alive, he behaved like a ghost story, leaving just enough gaps in his life to keep people guessing.
You know, he often took on the guise of the thing that he was escaping in order to escape. So, for example, when he hitchhiked to Canada to avoid the draft, he hitchhiked wearing a military uniform. So he presented himself as a soldier in order to escape the war. This was a typical Craven stunt. So when he disappeared at sea, this might well have been in the guise of a sailor in order to get somewhere that he wanted to go to. He lived from seaport to seaport.
But I wonder if he could have anticipated the price of that legacy on Mina. Every new story of Craven's exploits must have caused Mina tremendous distress. In one sense, these rumours probably gave her hope. Each story was a clue that her husband might still be out there, but at the same time, that hope must have been incredibly painful. Plus, these were stories describing a totally different Arthur Craven to the one she knew. All these new adventure stories of Craven, the criminal artist, seemed to shrug off Arthur's marriage in Mexico like it was just another performance. Mina returned to Mexico to search hospital records, prisons, cemeteries, but every lead was always a dead end.
The persistent rumors or sightings, perhaps, or theories about Craven are something that do haunt her through the rest of her life.
I'm speaking again with poet and law scholar Sandeep Palmer.
It was a mental shock from which she would never recover. And the sadness and longing of that and the uncertainty of it with certain periods kind of drive her mad, as it would anybody.
So the biggest problem I've been having is, yeah, it's this idea. I tell Sandeep that having read pages from Louis' memoir, I really believe that Arthur loved her and would never have willingly left her behind, let alone ghosted off to Tahiti or on some other elaborate con. But at the same time, all these posthumous echoes of Craven end up drowning out this love story. And it just can't help but introduce doubt into my mind.
But also, there's a really wonderful poem by Loy. It's actually on my wall. I wonder if that... It's super short. And it kind of speaks to what you've just said. Do you mind if I just read it?
Yeah, please.
I'll just pull it off the wall. It's from her manuscripts. It's just here. One thing we know for sure is that Loy loved him. But there's a poem that Loy writes quite late in her life, which is called Echo. In this poem, she's engaging with the myth of Echo and Narcissus. And if we believe that Craven was a narcissist,
then perhaps in some ways we can see this poem as Loy wishing to get his attention, but Crevan being so self-involved in this, as you say, kind of hall of mirrors or versions of himself, that he isn't actually able to suspend that for long enough to be able to really truly belong to someone else. The poem echo. Life is a loitering inquiry, a challenging cry, lashing the earless edifice of ceaseless mystery, origined in earth, piercing the sky, spurning our anxious why to rebound on us as echo, only echo. Echo is no answer.
Yeah. Mina Loy's poetry often seemed to be about trying to understand oneself, and yet something always eludes. It's as if no one language, no one approach is able to hold the truth. Loy's poetry was always concerned with such things, long, long before she met Arthur Craven. But at the same time, the whole life of Arthur Craven feels so much like the subject of one of Mina's poems. Sometimes it feels as if she wrote him into existence. This impossible shifting montage of a man who somehow existed outside both time and space.
Loy is, she's always thinking about the way one word suggests another. So as you read the work, you can sonically hear the way in which a word is leading to another word. But you can also see how there's a kind of logic that moves through that perhaps resists the idea of continuous syntactical logic or narrative, but is actually about trying to generate an idea through the momentum of the poem. And she does this in many ways, not just through her choice of words, but her use of the caesura, her use of the gap. And there's a wonderful poem called The Effectual Marriage where she uses the gap to imply a disconnect between the male and female, the husband and the wife in the poem. And it's a kind of space where you can almost fall into it and you can almost presuppose what is coming next. But she wants you to stop and pause.
This literary technique of the gap that Sandeep is talking about here, Loy's way of tricking the reader into thinking the sentence is going one way when in fact it's going another, so you hear both versions of a line at the same time in your head. This is almost a literary equivalent of the same stunt we've seen Arthur Craven pull all the way through his career. It's yet another version of the boxer's feint. He tells you where the story's going, you go to anticipate it, but by the time you realise you've been tricked, both the real and the imaginary have intertwined in your head. So whether Mina was inspired by Craven or Craven inspired by reading Mina, there's an echo of both of them hidden in those invisible little gaps that have become such a distinctive part of Loy's poetry. And I like the idea that other poets have gone on to mimic this technique, that it has in its own way become part of the language of poetry. This feels like a fitting tribute, the moment when one line of poetry somehow splits into two. You thought you knew what was happening, then all of a sudden, you fall into a gap.
Is everything okay?
Yeah.
You don't usually call me at work.
Yeah, I was just recording some voiceover for that BBC thing, and
I'm recording this, are you?
Yeah, no, sorry, I am recording.
Why?
This. You know, I've just been trying to. It's just, I'm sorry, I'm getting to the end of this series, and mm-hmm. I finally reached a point where I feel like the audience could finally start to be sympathetic towards Arthur Craven as a character, because like now they've seen him in Love. Like last episode, they got to hear some pages from Mina Loy's memoir. And so, like, we finally get to know that like, he's really this sensitive, quiet, loving soul. And, like, the sad thing is that because of this Faustian pact that Craven made with art at a young age, when Craven dies,
people only remember his nasty stage persona and like this whole beautiful love affair with Mina Loy gets forgotten. So it's a little bit like his art has erased his love, and I just think that's so terribly sad. And I think it speaks to this lack of control that any of us have over how we're remembered after we die. Because, like, who knows what story about us is going to be the one that sticks and which ones are going to be the ones that get forgotten. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so anyway, I just thought I would call my wife and tell her that I loved her. Because I do. I love you. And I just want that, like, the certainty of that, to be the thing that survives.
Okay. I know you want to believe this love story between Craven and Loy. I get how you see it as this beating heart beneath all the layers of thuggery and fakery. But really, this whole love story is just another story.
Okay.
You have to remember, this is something that Loy wrote down at the end of her life, after decades of pain and searching. I wouldn't blame her for wanting to simplify Craven down to something knowable, erasing all the uncertain parts, leaving this tender, gentle giant. But that doesn't mean it's true.
How do you know? Have we spoken about this before?
I know you want to draw a line between artist and con artist, but with Arthur Craven, that line just isn't there. I mean, maybe he did just leave her on that pier in Mexico. Maybe he didn't. You'll never know which, and you have to accept that.
Where are you calling? Are you on a boat? I can hear seagulls.
Are you even going to tell your listeners the stuff you left out in order to make Craven seem more sympathetic? Did you tell them that Craven was already married to another woman? Renée Boucher. Craven left her in Paris, so that's one wife left behind for starters.
I was going to do that, but I ran out of space.
Are you going to talk about how Craven betrayed his friends? How he sold André Lavelle a fake Picasso, then immediately left the country. The one guy offering him work when no one else would, Craven had no issue stepping on him to get what he wanted. He used all his friends the same way he used everyone else. He treated everyone like his personal art materials. It's almost as if people weren't real to him.
You're not actually my Wi-Fi. This isn't a real phone call.
Funny that.
The actor pretending to be my wife. She is making a good point, though. I mean, the actor pretending to be my wife is always making a good point. I guess that's why I pretended to marry her. All we have of Arthur Craven are echoes. There's no way to trace these echoes back to the source. There's no way to know which echoes are true and which ones are false. I know it's probably a little late in the day to admit this, but I think I've been going about this series completely the wrong way, right from the start. The Escape Artist, Episode 8, The Echo, was written, presented and produced by me, Ross Sutherland. It was produced for the BBC by Melvin Rickaby, additional voices by Angus Dunnican and Katie Bonner. The music was by Jeremy Wormsley.